So I think the part that you know I sort of have maybe a unique perspective on as a lending guy is there's a lot of what's being called like zombie companies.
I've heard of that, yeah.
Yeah, there's like tons of companies that are being held up only because they have government funding, and they're not actually there. So what that starts to do when you have like that at like a macro level, like with a whole economy that has a large portion that are zombie companies, it starts messing up the systems. One thing is you can't actually track what's happening in the economy. You can't say like, well, are we recovering or not? Because you don't know, are these guys actually in business or are they just staying afloat because they got some grants from the government? Literally grants, right? Because they're not true loans.
They're not true loans, right?
Very, no one's really going to pay that money back. So that's issue number one. And it means when the economy starts to like return back, getting back to normal, and lenders want to start lending again, they're going to have a really hard time because they're not going to know like who are the real companies and
Wow.
who are the zombie companies.
Your network is your net worth. Come listen to some of the most successful people I know. Share invaluable knowledge, stories, and advice in real estate, business, and beyond. This is Weiss Advice. Whether you want to take your business or personal life to the next level, look no further. Welcome back to Weiss Advice. I am your host, Yona Weiss, and today I am very pleased to bring you another Weiss, my good friend, brother from another mother, Russell Weiss, also known as Yerachmiel Elimelech, or Rachmiel Melech, how I like to call him. And, you know, this episode is going to be twice as nice. There's going to be some sacrifice, but if we get enough rhymes in there, it's going to be really good. Anyways, what's going on, Russell?
I don't know how we're going to get through the whole thing without getting past the Weiss joke. I mean, it's sort of like, we could spend a half hour just talking about that.
Well, yeah. I mean, listen, it's interesting. You know, we're probably could be brothers. You know, we have a lot in common, we're very good friends. And we've known each other for, I'd say, 15 years or so, close to. How long?
13 years.
13 yeah. years. Okay. He has a much better memory than I do. And the truth of the matter is, you know, I'd like to give a little bit of a context to who our guest is before we actually have this conversation. You guys know, Russell is probably one of the smartest people I know. And that's saying a lot because I know a lot of people.
So I'm like second to you. And that's the...
Right. He's also very humble, as you can see. And, you know, he does something in the business that is, in my opinion, a little unique on many levels. And we'll get into that. The company that he is a founder of and currently, you know, a partner and, you know, helping to make, you know, a huge splash in the industry that he's in, which you don't even know what that is yet, but I will get to it. But a little background, Russell, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself in 2 minutes or less?
Sure. So I always, when I describe myself proudly as a data nerd. Apparently, most of the world has gotten upgraded to data scientist, but I was called a data nerd since high school. And I've sort of stuck with that because it's working for me. Data nerds have great opportunities in a lot of fields. And the field that I found myself in is in lending. So I had most of my career in the US was at a company that some people have heard called American Express.
And
I worked on underwriting there. For the U.S. credit cards. And so if you've been approved for a U.S. credit card from American Express, you could thank me. And if you've been declined, then you could blame me. I came to Israel and I met this cool guy named Yoda Weiss in 2007. And I took a few years off from data stuff and the finance world. And then when I jumped back into finance in 2012, I joined a company called Behalf, which was one of the first entrants in fintech lending in the US. So we built all our technology in Israel and did lending in the US. Awesome experience, my first real experience as a startup and really getting to see what that looks like. And 2016, I was having so much fun at Bath, and I said, I wanna kind of do that again, start over. And I looked for a new opportunity. And looking across the world, Brazil is actually a really interesting place for lenders. The legislation is really helpful for lenders, a lot of great opportunities. So we founded Wheel in 2016 and hit market there. We were the first online lender in Brazil for small businesses. It's easy to be the biggest when you're first.
When you're the first, right. So let me stop you there for a second. So in 2016, you founded a new startup with a couple of partners called Wheel, W-E-E-L. Okay. And this is just to give a little perspective here. The other founders are Brazilian, right? You don't speak Portuguese.
Don't speak Portuguese. I'm good at faking it. I know when people are making fun of me.
Okay. So you started a new startup, which was an online lending startup, which was the first of its kind in Brazil in 2016. So tell us a little bit about how that journey, where that's taken you. Cause I know a lot of pieces of it. Obviously we're good friends. We, you know, I keep up to what you're up to over the years. Mm-hmm. And I know that, but for our listeners, you know, has it been a bumpy ride? Has it been a good ride? Where are you guys? What's the trajectory? What's it been like?
I mean, I think anybody that has a startup that doesn't have a bumpy ride, they're probably doing something illegal and they haven't gotten caught yet. So it's for sure it's been a bumpy ride. There's lots of ups and downs. Every day is sort of like a roller coaster. And in Brazil in particular, because it's a country that where the macro environment is just full of tons of risk. You know, the currency has gone through huge fluctuations pre-COVID.
Right.
COVID just kind of added the complications. So it's a macro environment where, you know, there's a lot of risk and legislation changing all the time and being ready for that. For some people, that's scary and not really fun for me. I like those kind of challenges.
You're the chief risk officer. I mean, that's your official title. So you like risk. I mean, when you're talking about finance, well, you jump into it, you know, with like that attitude, like, yeah, I'm going to take this on.
Yeah, I'm not a guy that like jumps out of planes, you know, that's not
that kind of risk.
What a chief risk officer does, but really what a good chief risk officer does, and I think, you know, especially if you're coming at it from a data perspective, is being able to manage risk. That's what it's all about. Right. And one of my big mentors in credit risk, his name's Ash Gupta. He was the chief risk officer at American Express for decades. He's like one of the gurus in the industry. And he always told us, he said, the job of risk is to make sure there's no surprises. What that means is stuff's going to happen. Yeah, there's stuff happening all the time, but we have to be able to predict that's going to happen and make sure we've taken the proper steps in advance.
To mitigate that.
Yeah.
And to manage that risk. That's a great perspective. Okay. So you guys are a startup. Now startups oftentimes have funding, right? That's how you grow, right? And being a lending company, you need a lot of funding because the more money you have, the more you can lend, right?
Yeah.
Makes sense.
That's how it works.
Now you guys had a really interesting ride with, you know, the Series A, Series B. I don't know, remember exactly where you guys are holding now, but you've kind of had some really big partners and potential partners that have come your way.
Yeah. So it's been that part of the journey. You know, startups do need to raise capital, and lending startups have to raise a lot of capital because you need capital to lend. Our seed round was with a factoring company, one of the largest factoring companies in Brazil, which was great because it gave us a lot of exposure to the industry, and they literally incubated the company. Our Series A was led by Menashe's, who they're the premier VC in Brazil, and then the equivalent of like a Series B was with Franklin Templeton, who's a global company in the financial services sector.
Yeah, huge multi-billion-dollar hedge fund. What would you call them? Like a
They're everything. They're everything. Trillions.
Yeah. Okay. So now you guys, right, fast forward to 2020, right? Pre-COVID, let's just, you know, first quarter of 2020, you guys are the biggest number one online lending company in Brazil. How much are you guys lending a month, a quarter? You know, I know that you had some crazy amount of growth. Like I remember you telling me a figure like, I don't know, 30% growth or something a month. At a certain point,
we hit around, you know, a few months ago, and this was like the most public number we put out. We crossed R1 billion in origination.
How much is that in American dollars?
Well, it's changed a lot because the real.
Despite COVID, I mean, obviously the world has been hit hard. Brazil has been one of the countries that's been hit the hardest. the economy and as well as, you know, in the public health. How's that affected you guys? You know, positive, negative, what's happened?
So in the early days of COVID, we had to take a very conservative perspective on lending. And that meant, you know, we have a very short-term book. Our book pretty much turns every 45 days because we're focused on the receivables, like factoring book. Mm-hmm. So we had to basically, you know, cut off a lot of our suppliers because it just wasn't clear what was happening in the market. We took that step and kind of waited to see what, you know, where the economy was headed. And then around August, September, things we could see kind of what was stabilizing, what kind of industries were kind of already crushed. Mm-hmm. And then we started to rebuild. And our growth since then has been phenomenal, partially helped by some government funding. The government, it's not quite as big as PPP.
Interesting.
In the US, but there was a Brazilian equivalent of PPP called Piaki, which we led. We were actually the largest distributor of Piaki in Brazil.
Oh, interesting. So you partnered together with the government to provide those loans to businesses,
yeah.
Individuals?
Yeah, the government had a program similar to the US PPP program that they distributed through banks, and then banks needed partners like us to originate those loans, process them very quickly, and you know, get them out to the public.
And you are, just to give a little more context here, because we didn't mention this before, Wheel is a business lending company, individual loans, like what type of loans, car loans, you know, real estate loans. Tell us, like, what kind of loans are these that you guys are facilitating?
Only business. We only do business. And historically, we had done a lot of work in factoring, which is receivable-based lending. Mm-hmm. Since COVID, though, now a lot of players had gotten settled. You know, the market kind of cleared out,
yeah.
and allowed us to kind of dive into a lot of other areas. So now we're doing everything, but everything within the realm of business financing.
Business financing. Gotcha. Okay. Very good. So you talked about the PPP loans, which have been very big in the US.
Yeah.
A lot of media, a lot of, you know, things have been going around about it. I think a lot of people don't really understand.
Yeah.
What's your perspective on the PPP loans, how that's worked? I mean, obviously you're American, but your business is fully operational in Brazil.
Yeah, so I think my experience doing the Piaki, which is like the Brazilian equivalent, gave me a fresh perspective on PPP. PPP distributed, you know, something on the order of like $1 trillion. It's a lot of money. The conservative estimates of like how much that actually reached who it's supposed to reach, let's say something like 95%. Well, pretty good, right? But that means there's like $50 billion,
wow,
that went to companies that shouldn't have gotten money.
Wow.
Fill in the blank, right? Fraudsters, terrorists, like whatever you want.
That's
so
crazy.
That's a lot of money. And to put that in perspective, that's more money than the entire distribution for the whole Brazil, for legitimate companies. So what happens when you distribute like $1 trillion and some of it misses? So the part that misses, well, that's a real problem, right? Because that got in the hands of bad guys. And the part that worked, well, did all that go to like companies that really needed it?
Right. And not only companies that needed it, like did the companies actually use that money for rebuilding or helping the company stay afloat, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So I think the part that you know, I sort of have maybe a unique perspective on as a lending guy is there's a lot of what's been called like zombie companies.
I've heard of that, yeah.
Yeah. There's like tons of companies that are being held up only because they have government funding. But they're not actually there. So what that starts to do when you have like that at like a macro level, like with a whole economy that has a large portion that are zombie companies, it starts messing up the systems. One thing is you can't actually track what's happening in the economy. You can't say like, well, are we recovering or not? Because you don't know, are these guys actually in business or are they just staying afloat because they got some grants from the government? Literally grants, right? Because they're not true loans.
They're not true loans.
Right. No one's really going to pay that money back. So that's issue number one. And it means when the economy starts to like return back, getting back to normal, and lenders want to start lending again, they're going to have a really hard time. Because they're not going to know like who are the real companies,
wow,
and who are the zombie companies. So my big concern for the U.S. economy is that this approach of kind of just like giving money to everybody without really paying attention to where it's going, in the end, I think it's going to slow the recovery. And it's a big concern. I think that's why a lot of economists are seeing bigger opportunities in developing nations, where they actually have to kind of duke it out and kind of just suffer through the hard times. But at the end of the day, you actually can see, well, is it working or not?
That's very interesting. And to put, you know, just to throw something else into the mix here in understanding this, just out of my own curiosity, you mentioned before that Brazil has had a, you know, a fluctuating currency.
Yeah.
Now, you know, how do you factor that in to the fact that now, you know, I don't know how they went ahead and lent this money, but the U.S. obviously just printed trillion, you know, tons of money and just threw that in the economy, which is obviously going to create a big, you know, dip in the strength of the dollar. Is that happening in Brazil as well?
In Brazil, it is happening for other reasons. I mean, it's happened historically, but it's sort of stabilized now. You know, Brazil has sort of hit its bottom and it can't, it's not going to get any worse. It's, you know, I think the currency is sort of stable. The dollar is not stable right now. And I think the Americans are not used to it. Brazilians are used to it. You know, if they need to, they hedge their money. I mean, they're used to a currency that fluctuates. The dollar is now a currency that has been hugely devalued compared to what Americans are used to. And and that's a trend that's going to continue. I think most Americans are not really worried about it, right? Because they're not thinking about, well, you know, I don't need to buy stuff from China. I don't need to buy stuff from Europe. But overall, you know, that very aggressive approach of printing money makes the country poor.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does that affect the, you know, regular, you know, Tom, Dick, and Harry? Like, how does that affect the individual?
Eventually, it starts to, because when inflation starts to come in, and people just, they find, well, I don't have as much money as I thought I did. I can't buy the things I used to be able to buy.
Right. So that's obviously a big problem.
Yeah, it's a big watch out. And I think the opportunity now is just for people to start thinking more globally, to start thinking about opportunities outside the US. And if there for sure is going to be a world recovery, right? But the distribution of that recovery is going to vary by region. And the pace is going to be different. And you know, the U.S. got the hardest hit by COVID.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At least the recorded hardest hit.
Yeah. So you know, there's a lot of reason to think that the recovery is going to take time. And I think smart investors are starting to think more globally about their investments.
Now, speaking of globally, obviously, you guys started this company in Brazil. This lending, but the concept can really be transferable to other countries, other economies. And I think that's something that you guys were thinking about previously. Is that still something on your, you know, on your schedule in terms of building out to other, you know, bringing this program or this, I guess, concept to other countries?
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. I mean, Brazil's the biggest economy in LATAM, so it's a natural place for us to start. As we think about expansion, we want to kind of expand into the rest of LATAM. So Mexico is a clear target for us in this year, not necessarily through our own brand, could be through partners, but that's where, you know, we're going to be heading, and then kind of expanding out throughout the rest of LATAM, and then after that, Europe. I think that's the next natural place.
Gotcha. Tell me a couple of things that are unique about Brazil that made that country the primary target for this, you know, this lending, online lending platform that you guys created.
Well, one of the cool things in Brazil is that they have a national invoicing system. That doesn't sound so cool. Like, it's not like like surfing or something, but for a data guy, that's actually very, very cool, because it means that every invoice in Brazil has the same exact data format. When
every
you buy
business,
bananas,
that's crazy.
Yeah, when you buy anything, the government knows about it, and they know about it in a standard format. So for a data guy, I can actually see the whole economy, or as much as I can acquire from the government database, and I can understand kind of what's happening. And I don't have to sit through, you know, hundreds and hundreds of different invoice formats to collect the data. There's mm-hmm. one format. So it's really easy to understand. So Brazil was the first country to do that. They did that not to help lenders. They did it to prevent tax evasion.
Interesting.
Before the implementation of national invoicing, something like 40, maybe 50% of the economy was off the map.
Mm-hmm.
When they implemented it, it was a total flip. The whole country went along with it and complied with the national invoicing. So the government had a clear understanding of what was happening in the economy. And then other countries copied them. Mexico copied them, Chile, and expanded even now into Europe.
Wow, that's really fascinating. To give a little perspective, like what is that like in the US in terms of like how many different types of invoicing are there?
There's hundreds. There's probably like 300 or 400. And to think that this will never happen in the US because the state governments have too much control. You'd have to get all the mm-hmm. states to agree on a common format.
Right.
Just never.
Never going to happen. For sure. Oh, so that's cool. So that allowed you guys to really understand the market, understand the economy, figure out who was going to be, you know, the target prospects for this lending. And you guys built out this system. What is the, you know, Brazil, a lot of people think of it like a third world country to a certain extent, because it does have that diversity in it. I mean, you do have, you know, jungles, and you do have, you know, cities like Rio and others that are large, you know, metropolises. So mm-hmm. how does that, how does that factor in?
Yeah, so it is very diverse. It's one of the seventh largest economy in the world.
Seventh largest. So, okay.
Yeah. So it's on the map, you know. mm-hmm.
Despite the diversity.
Yeah, and it matters a lot. You know, huge problems in terms of distribution of wealth, and across all sectors, both in terms of individuals, but also even within companies. Think about in the U.S. You know, there's hundreds of banks. There's actually thousands of banks. And banking is distributed. In Brazil, four banks control 80% of deposits.
Wow.
So, you know, that's been a historical challenge for growth in countries like Brazil. Mm-hmm. But this shifts in terms of technology, things that fintech and things that changes like in e-commerce, that's creating more of a level playing field. And when you have that level playing field, it actually is a huge growth opportunity for a country. That ultimately ends up in a more natural distribution of wealth.
Amazing. So let me switch gears here a little bit. We are, you know, kind of short on time before we get to the final four, but I do want to ask you about the fact that you guys are an Israeli startup company, right? Based in Israel, you have employees, you have a whole company, and you're also operational in Brazil, obviously. That's the country that all the business is in. And you're getting a lot of recognition from the Brazilian government itself. Is that correct? Is that accurate statement?
Yeah. The Brazilian president was one of the first presidents from Latin America to visit Israel. And we actually led that delegation. We had a ton of time with him and got to introduce him to other Israeli companies that we thought could benefit Brazil. Yeah, it's kind of given me the opportunity to kind of wear a different hat, not just like a business guy, but also being
a diplomat.
You know, yeah, a little bit of a diplomat.
Oh, that's great. And it's amazing that really it just goes to show you that you can be anywhere in the world. And, you know, nowadays with technology, you can run a company, right? Start a company in a different country.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not just start a company, run a country, but be the best of the best. I mean, you guys are making huge waves in terms of being the number one, you know, lender in the country, doing as much over $1 billion, you know, of originations in the currency of the country. I mean, it's huge.
Yeah. It's truly a global economy now, and people can, they could be anywhere and run a company anywhere.
Awesome. Well, Rachman, let's jump into the final four. These are questions I ask all of my guests at the end. I didn't tell you what they were before, so you're just
gonna have to watch all your episodes.
Oh, there you go. Oh, we got a avid listener. So you can ask me then if you know the question. No, I'm just kidding. First question is, what is the worst job that you ever had?
I had a job many years ago in consulting, right? It was 100% travel. 100% travel means you don't have a home, you live in hotels. That sounds fun, and it's fun for like a week, and then you start to get a stomach ache and, you know, get uncomfortable sleeping in a different bed every other day. And part of the other reasons I didn't like that job is the people that want to travel long term are usually a little weird. Now, I'm weird, but I wasn't that weird.
You're weird in a different way.
Yeah. So I started to pick that up. It took me a while, you know, but if I started to notice that, I was like, wow, people that travel their whole lives, it's a kind of a weird life. You know?
Right. This was before you settled down and started a family, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you're still single. Well,
my single days. That was a pretty bad job. And I was very happy that I left and kind of to a more normal path.
Yeah, definitely. I'm glad too. What is a book that you've read that's given you a paradigm shift?
I knew you were going to ask that question, and I brought the book. So for those that can see the video, I want to share this book. It's called The Positivity Bias, Practical Wisdom for Positive Living, inspired by the life and teachings of the Lubavitcher Rebbe.
Yes, I actually picked this up when I was in your house, and I read portions of it.
You know, there's some books that you read once and you never read again. And this is a book I think I've already read two or three times, cover to cover. And it's each time I'm getting new things. What's the big paradigm shift is this concept of a positivity bias. That's a starting point to think that the world is great. If your starting point's there, the world's great. It's great. If your starting point's there, it only gets better.
I mean, and this is taken from teachings of a person in Lubavitcher Rebbe who was, if you've never heard of this person, he was a prolific visionary and, you know, action-based. I mean, what he did in his lifetime and what has continued, you know, beyond his lifetime is just no short of a miracle, you know, basically, if you look at it like that. But hearing from his teachings are just incredibly wonderful. And it's broken up in such a way. Correct me if I'm wrong. It looks like a pretty thick book there, but it's broken up in such a way. There's like little tidbits and little stories and things like one after the other. So you really could kind of read it over and over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really intended to be, because I think what the Rebbe's approach is for people to be able to implement these things in their life.
Right.
That it's not just a conceptual approach. This is something the person can live with and bring a lot of more joy to their own life. And a person that's living with that same kind of joy can help other people live with that same joy.
100%.
That's a paradigm shift that grows on itself.
100%. That's awesome. What is a skill or talent that you would like to learn? Now, I know you play a number of musical instruments or have, so it's not going to be one of those.
You know, I have like 50 things I'm thinking right now. But for some reason, the one that's jumping to the top, and so it must be, this is where my heart is pulled the most, is that I want to become a great dancer.
Yeah. I could see that. What type of dance? Like ballet? What do you...
I don't want to swing. Dance. I don't want to be able to dance. I want to be able to dance in a way that expresses like how I'm feeling.
That's awesome. It's an incredible form of, you know, number one, exercise. But I think it's actually, when I read this once somewhere, that it's actually probably one of the greatest forms of exercise there is, because it combines the spiritual with the physical exercise. Because dancing is something that really, because you're doing it with music most of the time, obviously, and that really brings about, you know, music is a very spiritual kind of channeling energy that has to it. No matter what kind of music it is, it's different energies there. So bringing that together is actually fascinating. That's quite fascinating. I would not have guessed that. Of the 50 things that are in your mind, that probably was not on my list of 50 that I would have thought you would have guessed.
I think it's because there's certain things you can't express with words. So if you can't express it with words, like I feel I'm probably held back in my self-expression because I don't have a word for it. And I think dance, that's the place that dance, you know, is supposed to fill.
Interesting. Well, all forms of art in a way.
Yeah.
Including music, which you can relate to because like you said, you play musical instruments. So you can relate to that.
Yeah.
Okay. That's fascinating. Okay. Fourth and final question. What does success mean to you?
That's a really good question.
That's why I ask it.
the way I view success is not something external. You know, I've had external successes. I've had external failures. When I say external, I really mean like in material areas. What I view as, and I actually mean a successful life. What does a successful life look like? But for me, I think a successful life is one where a person feels like they're choosing their life. And now that doesn't mean that they are there's certain things you can't choose, right? There's certain areas of life you don't have that much control over. But even those areas that you don't have control over, you can still choose them, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah, I do. I don't understand what you mean.
You know, a person can say like, hey, you know, I'm not 6 feet tall. It didn't work out, but you know what? I like it. I mean, I can choose that. I can choose to be a guy that's not 6 feet tall.
So it's really, I mean, like it's similar to the book you pointed out before, the positivity bias. It's really a choice. Like, just like positivity is a choice, it's perspective. You know, your perspective on every single thing in life is your choice. So if you choose to be successful, I guess is what you're saying, within right. what you have, then you will be.
Yeah.
Very exactly. interesting. We've never had anyone really give that answer in, you know, about 100 interviews or so. So that's why I like it, because it's such a unique question. It's, what does it mean to you? And everyone has a different interpretation.
Yeah.
But Russell, where can our listeners find you or reach out to you if they choose to?
LinkedIn. That's what everybody lives on, LinkedIn.
Everyone's on LinkedIn. I thought it was just me. right. You were one of the few people when I signed up for LinkedIn like 10 years ago that was, you know, the few people that I connected with that I actually knew. And it was only until about a few years ago that you just started reaching out and connecting with anyone and everyone. But it used to be, right? You just know the people that you actually knew in life. But yeah. Okay. So find Russell on LinkedIn. We'll put a link in case you can't figure out who he is. The cool thing about Wheel is everyone has a bright yellow branded background on their picture. So you stand out in a crowd.
Yeah. People will find us.
People will find you over there. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Really enjoyed this conversation. And thanks for joining me.
Awesome.
And to all our listeners, don't forget, the best advice comes only when you ask. Real quick, I have one question for you. Did you like this episode? If you did, I want to ask you a huge favor. See, the biggest thing that helps this podcast grow and that will spread this message to the whole world is that if you leave a review, a rating, and subscribe to the podcast. What that does is it basically tells the platforms that this podcast is out on is that you like my stuff and I'm doing something right. So take a few seconds out of your day, hit that subscribe button, leave a rating or review. I would be extremely grateful. Also, I want to hear from you guys. So I want to hear some feedback. If you have any questions for future episodes, please find me on LinkedIn. Send me a DM, a connection request, Yona Weiss, and I'd love to hear from you.